Hello and welcome to this episode of Bite Back Chats Books, where we chat to Linda McDougall. Linda is a journalist, television producer and author of Cherie, The Perfect Life of Mrs. Blair and Westminster Women. She's also known for being the wife of the late Austen Mitchell, who was a British journalist and the Labour Member of Parliament for Great Grimsby from 1977 until 2015. Linda's latest book, Marcia Williams, The Life and Times of Baroness Falkander, seeks to realign Marcia, who was Harold Wilson's political advisor, away from previously dismissive and misogynistic verdicts. This pioneering biography suggests a more nuanced context centered around Marcia's unbreakable partnership with Wilson, that they were in fact politically wedded to one another and equal contributors to his success. Today, we hope to find out what made Marcia such a remarkable force, how she propelled Wilson's career, and what comparisons we can draw with today's political scene. Hi, Linda. Thanks so much for coming on this episode of Bite Back Chats Books. My first question really is, what made you want to write a book about Marcia?
Well, sad and strange things happened in my life all at the same time. My husband, who was an MP, a backbench Labour MP, retired in 2015. And that meant all of a sudden our lives changed completely. We went from living incredibly busy lives in London to coming back to our house in Yorkshire, which is, he hadn't been very well for the last few years that he'd been an MP in. So we came back here to start a new sort of life. We were largely based in Yorkshire, and I sort of felt I would need to find something else to do apart from after a whole life of working so hard. When someone stops being an MP, it's a bit of an enormous shock, because it's like my grandfather's clock stopped short, never to go again. You know? And so Austen started writing things and doing things, and I couldn't do my job really, which is being a television director.
Yeah.
So I thought about, I don't know, we talked a lot about people that we knew, and because of my, I've always had a passionate interest in feminism since I was a kid at school, and I started looking at people who had been in the Commons when Austen was there and talking about it. I sort of discovered Marcia because she was so universally hated by anyone who'd written a word about her. And also because we were living in Yorkshire, we did know a lot of people who turned out to be characters in Marcia's story, particularly the Kagan family.
Yes.
So I that's how it all began, really. And then I got to talk to Bite Back about it, and
there we go.
Book mission. Now, the funny thing is, the book that you've got now isn't the book that you would have got if Austen had stayed alive. Sadly, when he died, there died with him all the political expertise, because even though I've made lots of programmes about politics, always my whole job as a television producer was always story-led stuff. And I wanted things that stories always that appealed to most people. Well, when I started looking at Marcia, I began to think, what a great story, because there was this woman who was obviously doing great things, but managed to evoke the ire of everybody around her almost as soon as she started working with them. And of course, the first thing you have to say is most of those people who she was working with were men.
Yes.
So she seemed to have a unique method of upsetting the men she worked with, as in the story told by those men. Mm. But you really had to have a bit of a look at it and realize that in each case, in the case of the civil servants in Downing Street, they just simply didn't want someone from another part of politics intervening on their soil. Because up until Marcia arrived in Downing Street, the relationship between civil servants and SPADs, well, SPADs didn't exist, but the relationship between the Prime Minister and the civil servants and other people were less important. But Marcia wasn't like that. she and Harold had worked together as a team, and she'd done 50% of the work all the way through. And so she wasn't giving in. And she said, we've arrived in Downing Street. And she told Harold quite brusquely, you go off and sort it out with them. I would like this room next to the cabinet room. And tell them that I want to be called your private secretary. Well, the first word that couldn't be used was private, because that the private office is the where the civil servants are. So essentially, it was the very beginnings of the life of political advisors. And I mean, we all know famous political advisors now. We know about Dominic Cummings and what he did, and all there are literally hundreds of them wandering the streets of Westminster. But Master was the very first.
And what do you think made her such a remarkable force?
Well, I think that when she and Harold Wilson first met, there's no doubt they were dramatically attracted to one another. There's a bit that she described herself when she was talking about the night they met. And she said that how kind he was to her, and he could see how difficult it was. There were these Russians all having rows with Labour MPs and Labour leaders. And she had been asked by her boss to take shorthand notes about the proceedings. And she'd been straight out of university into secretarial college and then to work for the Labour Party. So she was nervous and had little experience. But somehow they appealed to one another. I think Harold was probably quite naive when it came to women. I think one would judge from his relationship with his wife that having a wife and having children, all these things, being a very practical Yorkshireman, I think Harold probably had a list and had all these things had to be ticked off. So he was doing pretty well getting his life organised, but Marcia upset all that. She was kind of unpredictable, and in the manner of very clever, strange people with unusual talents, she sort of didn't need to be taught. She knew. She had a solid political way of thinking, and she became enormously useful to him immediately. And I don't think that he ever thought again about not having her as part of his life. I think she was just as essential to him in his office and his work as his wife was essential to him at home. I think, well, it's not exactly an unfamiliar story, is it, that men need assistance to have the lives that they have, I think, you know, that without helpers. But traditionally, and looking back 50 years, which is what we're doing, it would seem an enormous way in the development of women's careers. There was that Marcia's only real problem was that she wasn't male. If she'd been brilliantly clever and been at Oxford and Cambridge with all the politicians she was surrounded by, then perhaps she, like Barbara Castle, might have taken a different role. But she was the thing she was good at, administration. She was particularly politically astute, could see the political picture. And lots of people have, in Bernard Donoghue's diaries, when he first meets her, he's tremendously impressed and says, but she was so amazing. She really knew more about politics than anyone else around her. Not possible, but she gave that impression. Roy Jenkins said she was one of the finest political minds of her generation. She was just very talented.
Yeah.
And so it was very hard to get a place to be talented in if you were female.
Yes. And why was it that she was so badly portrayed, and who fueled this gossip in Wilson's office?
The civil servants worked really hard to suggest that she was, they said patronisingly, tremendously good at her work, like any competent constituency secretary.
Yeah.
Now, if somebody said that to someone today, they would understand that as a giant insult, but men didn't really believe that pigeonholing women like that was wrong or unusual, and so they continued to do it. There was a guy, an important guy in the beginning, called George Wigg, who was really the person who organized Harold's leadership campaign. And he said very similar things about Marcia, that she was difficult. Most of all these men said Marcia had a hold over Harold. And what was it? And that story went on really throughout her life at Westminster. Did she have a hold over Harold? What was it? Most of the men would, I'm assuming, suspect that it was a sexual hold.
Yeah.
I think there's probably no doubt at all that they had a sexual relationship in the beginning, but I think it would have been too complicated, and it obviously didn't work, as later events proved. So they had an amazingly close relationship, and I don't think he could really manage without her.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few publications where there were accusations thrown around, and she had some children by Walter Terry, and then
that's hugely important, because she had those two children. She began to have relationships when 1964 Labour became the government, and so they moved into Downing Street. Marcia did establish a role for herself in that she took over the whole management of the MPs and the management of the constituency. She took over the political side of Harold's life, where the civil servants took over the running of the countryside of Harold's life. That's what civil servants are there to do. But there hadn't been someone to run the political side of life in Downing Street for her. She did that meticulously, but she obviously began to think, well, this is not much fun for me. Who wouldn't think that? And Harold's got a family. He's got a wife and two kids to go home to at night. I've got nobody. So she obviously, like any young woman, started having relationships. And so none of these relationships worked very well. And you have to remember, there's only one of Marcia. Whereas you would think today in Downing Street, you've got all this, a team.
Yeah.
Dare we say a team of partygoers who who run the other side of things. There was no team of partygoers. Marcia, and there was no money to employ Marcia. So Marcia had to be employed by Harold himself. In fact, for pretty much her whole life at Westminster, Harold paid Marcia out of his own pocket.
Yeah.
She was, as she explained herself, she was it. She used to answer the telephone and then sort of pretend that she would go and consult someone else and then come back. But they really ran it as two people. And other women came in Downing Street, because of course there were typists, et cetera, other people who worked there. And Marcia didn't get on very well with them either, because she bossed them around and took control of the department that she and Harold were. So she irritated people, and she started falling in love with people, because I think, like anyone else, she wanted to, have a husband and family. So one of the people that she fell in love with, the chief political correspondent of the Daily Mail, who was a married guy with two kids. And not quite sure why, because in fact, one of Joe Haynes's great jokes was that when he was told about the arrival of, when Marcia was pregnant the second time, someone had said to him, "Hasn't she heard of birth control?" There's never any mention of birth control in any of the stuff about the babies. Anyway, she got pregnant. And by this stage, Harold had on his side, a medical advisor, as I suppose all prime ministers do. And this is a guy who was called Dr. Joseph Stone, a distinguished guy. During the war, he'd been a paramedic in the British Army, and he'd been one of the first people in Debelsen when the concentration camps were closed down. And so he was a very humane and decent bloke, and he really loved Harold. And he was, they'd met playing golf on a Saturday afternoon, I think, in Hampstead Garden suburb, and they became lifelong friends. He worried enormously about Marcia. He worried about, because like so many men at the time, he worried that she had this influence over her boss.
Yeah.
And so obviously he knew that she was having a baby, and he in fact delivered the baby, or if he didn't deliver it, he was certainly, the first baby was born in a nursing home in Hendon, which is where his GP surgery was. And on the birth certificate, he signs his name as being present at the birth of the baby. So it gives the address of the nursing home and doesn't mention the father of the baby at all. Mm. 10 months after the birth of the first baby, Marcia had a second son,
wow,
also by the same guy. Now, I want you to realise that all through this, she is still working and doing a full-time job in Downing Street. Mm. But no one would admit or believe, or if they did know, would say that they knew that any of this was going on. It was all covered up.
Mm.
These were the days before Private Eye really got going, and Private Eye was the first people to reveal anything, because of course newspapers were much more controlled by their proprietors then, and there was a real opportunity to stop this sort of information getting out. So one of the reasons why this story is so intriguing is that there's Marcia working away, running half of the Prime Minister's life. At the same time, she's the secret mother of two children. And it wasn't till the eldest one was 7 and then the other one was 6, I think, that Private Eye actually revealed that of their existence. They were completely covered up all that first government time in Downing Street.
Mm.
Amazing.
Would you say that there was a sort of turning point in Marcia's career, number 10? I'm thinking of sort of when she was prescribed Purple Hearts and started taking Valium to deal with the stress. Do you think that's...
I think what happened, Neil, is that it got tougher and tougher. I mean, can you imagine if you or I had two kids and we would do a big job in Downing Street? I think it got tougher and tougher. And I think it was tougher and tougher for everyone involved. And it was really hard. And Harold got embarrassed about things, and he decided when Joe Haynes arrived, which was just before Labour lost the 1970 election.
Yes.
So they just when they moved into opposition. And so Harold told Joe Haynes about the baby.
Yeah.
And Joe was absolutely appalled. He couldn't believe it. He'd never... Joe is a magnificent and wonderful journalist who is purer than snow, really, and kind of puritanical, and hasn't moved with the times, and still believes that Marcia was a wicked witch who had this terrible hold over her boss. And he believes to this day that he had, you know, that life was unhappy and he had to spend an enormous amount of time saving Harold from Marcia. Well, I don't think that's true. I think he certainly spent a lot of time rescuing Marcia, because of course the situation, you're right, she took Purple Hearts, which I gather was pretty common at the time. To take, if you wanted to stay up all night and work hard, then it was the answer. I think when I was at university, people did the same. But because Dr. Stone became so worried about how, shall we say, unstable she was, he decided, and this was terribly popular, I know this from my own experiences, at the time, everyone thought they'd found nirvana for worried, tired housewives.
Yeah.
With the arrival of Valium.
Valiums, yeah.
You could remember the Rolling Stones song, Mother's Little Helper.
Yeah.
And, Doctor, please, some more of these. So Marcia developed a habit of taking lots and lots of amphetamines to try and keep her awake at night. And then at the other end of the day, and when she got stressed out, taking lots and lots of benzodiazepines to calm her down. And the results, as we now know, of taking Valium were bad enough, because Valium is, especially in large quantities, is peculiarly addictive and hard to stop taking. Professors would have said, but it was a huge problem at the time, harder to stop it than to stop taking heroin. So she became, all the things of which she was accused sort of came true, because she was difficult, and she did become more difficult, and she did shout at people, and she did, I love the diaries of Bernard Donohue, because he's the one who gave, he wrote diaries every night all through his time in Downing Street in the 74-76 period. And it's wonderful to read about his admiration for Marcia when he first arrived, how clever she was, how smart she was. But then people began to see that she got very distressed very easily, would shout and scream at people, and life became very tough indeed. I don't want to blame her, because she was victim of circumstance. But what I do want is I want people to see what a great job she did, and she deserves our gratitude and our interest for what she did in Downing Street.
Yeah, and now I have a bit of more of a fun or silly question. If you could be a fly on the wall in any of the moments mentioned in the book, which would you choose?
Well, funnily enough, it's easy. It's something that couldn't happen in a million years today. Back in the far off days of the late 60s, Downing Street didn't have those great clunky gates at the end. And people could actually drive up and down it, I think. I certainly walked up and down it. Anyway, one night someone was going in who had an appointment to see Harold in the evening, in the dark, just like it's getting now. And as he walked up Downing Street, he saw the chief political correspondent of the Daily Mail's car sitting outside number 10, and thought, oh. So he peered in the window, and to his amazement, there was the chief political correspondent and Marcia wrapped in a passionate embrace inside number 10. And he was very embarrassed, so he scuttled off inside, went to have a drink with Harold. And 5 minutes later, Marcia and said boyfriend turned up, walked in and said, oh, hello. And the boyfriend offered drinks all round. And I would have thought that was your perfect Netflix moment, really.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. And so you worked as a television producer. If or when there's a biopic film about Marcia, of Marcia, who would you like to play her?
It would be really good, a biopic film about Marcia. It would full of passion.
Yeah.
Well, the person I'm a big admirer of, who I think would be able to cope with all the wild different parts of Marcia's personality, is Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Great answer.
Perhaps she'd write the script as well.
Perhaps you'd write the script. I can see that. That's a great answer. And what parallels do you think we can draw today with modern politics? I mean, is there anyone that she's similar to, Marcia?
Absolutely. There's someone we're waiting to find out about. Who will presumably be the modern equivalent of Marcia.
Okay.
And we all want to know how it's going to be done these days. And that is this mysterious lady called Sue Gray.
Of course.
Because the nearest we've got to Marcia these days is Sue Gray, who is going to be what I'm assuming is the next prime minister, unless there's a dramatic improvement in things at the moment. Sue Gray has been hired by the opposition leader, to run his office. And I guess that's what you would have said about Marcia. So I'm imagining that Sue Gray will be someone, one to watch, and we need to learn, you know, presumably she'll do it in a wonderful way, and we'll all
watch this space.
Long in the past.
Well, it's been great having you on this episode, and your book, Marcia Williams, The Life and Times of Baroness Fonda, is out on the 7th of November. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bite Back podcast. Marcia Williams' The Life and Times of Baroness Falkander is out on the 7th of November. Head to the Bite Back website to use the exclusive 20% off code Marcia20. And do get in touch with us on Twitter with your questions or queries at Bite Back Pub.